Economic statistics do sometimes lend themselves to political hyperbole. It's true. The healthcare economy, though, really is that big. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, it is the 20th of June. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Here is what we know right now about the Senate's healthcare bill. Pretty much the same thing we knew yesterday, right? Which is that it's still a secret. There are some senior members of the Republican Party in the Senate. All right, Bob Corker of Tennessee is his name, who are saying that the text is going to be made public on Thursday. That's the day after tomorrow, with a vote a week later. While we wait for that, though, and the CBO score on a bill that is going to affect a sixth of the American economy, a little truth squatting. Of that number, the 17 or so percent of all of this country's economic activity, we are constantly told, is devoted to healthcare in one way or another. Where did that number come from? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
According to the most recent data from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, we spend $3.2 trillion a year on healthcare. That is, indeed, about a sixth of our GDP.
The biggest bucket is hospitals. Second biggest bucket is doctors. Third biggest bucket is retail pharmaceuticals.
Lawton Robert Burns teaches healthcare management at Wharton. So hospitals, doctors, and drugs. And there's plenty of stuff that isn't even tallied up in that $3.2 trillion.
Informal spending, you know, alternative medicine, taking care of the family members as informal caregivers.
So at least 18% of every dollar spent in the U.S. goes to healthcare, which, by the way, is more than in any other developed country. But there was a time when it was much, much less.
If we were to go back to 1960, then healthcare spending as a percent of GDP was about 5%.
Nicole Smith is a healthcare economist at Georgetown. She says one reason healthcare spending has risen so much is we got Medicaid and Medicare. But there's more to the rise in spending than just that.
A lot of the spending that we do has to do with the type of technology we use for healthcare.
Also, as we've gotten wealthier as a country, we can afford to spend more. So we do. And if you think about it, healthcare is kind of a seller's market. Len Nichols studies health policy at George Mason.
It is, frankly, market power of the providers that make it pretty difficult to rein in cost growth.
After all, are you going to settle for half a cure of something or pay for the best cure you can afford? In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Speaker of the House Paul Ryan gave a tax policy speech this afternoon. He promised once again to get tax reform, not tax cuts, but tax reform, the whole enchilada, done this year. Until then, our tax news comes to us in other forms. ExxonMobil said today it is going to sign on to a plan for a carbon tax. Counterintuitive, perhaps, for an oil company, or, as Marketplace's Ryan Kailath explains, completely logical.
Climate change solutions don't get much simpler than a carbon tax. Make pollution more expensive, and you'll get less of it. Economists, rational beings that they are, love this idea. The reason it never happens, says Ted Halstead, is because regular humans are irrational.
We're asking people to make short-term sacrifices now for benefits that accrue to other people in other countries in 40 years. It just doesn't work.
Halstead's chief executive of the Climate Leadership Council, this coalition of mostly conservatives that Exxon just joined. He says his plan goes straight to people's self-interest.
What if the government wrote you a check each month to fight global warming?
Here's what he means. The government charges companies for burning carbon. In the case of an oil company, that cost gets passed down to the consumer. About 36 cents a gallon added to the price of gas. But the government would offset that cost by cutting you a check every month.
We believe that markets are far more effective in solving climate change than regulation.
A plain old tax, instead of a labyrinth of complex regulations, is the selling point for industry.
All of these companies really want this. It's actually in their interest, and they know it.
Rob Virchik's a climate policy expert at Loyola University. He says regulation is difficult, inefficient, and changes with the mood of Washington. But a tax, you can just write that into your budget.
It gives companies more control and more ability to plan.
Especially if they can be part of the planning process. The global conversation about carbon regulation is already happening. With their own plan in hand, oil companies are more prepared to have that talk. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
The Commerce Department is expected to wrap up an investigation into the national security risks of relying on imported steel any day now. The White House has accused China of dumping cheap steel and hurting American producers. But whatever action the president takes, tariffs or otherwise on this, they are going to cut both ways. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank has that one.
Steel is in everything, from ammo to fighter jets. But University of Michigan professor Linda Lim says the White House's national security rationale is a stretch.
I think they just want to restrict steel imports. And it's difficult to find a reason to do so. And this hasn't been tried a lot.
The National Security Clause comes from Section 232 of the 1962 Trade Expansion Act. It's only been used twice before. The statute gives President Trump a lot of latitude to decide which imports are threats and which aren't. But trade lawyer Tim Keeler at Mayer Brown says the move is unlikely to hurt China much.
A lot of Chinese steel products are already subject to anti-dumping duties.
China accounts for only about 3% of U.S. steel imports. Instead, tariffs would hit trading partners like Canada, Mexico, and Germany. They could challenge tariffs at the World Trade Organization or impose their own protectionist measures, says Gary Huffbauer at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
What these countries tend to do is look for a district which votes for President Trump and a product which those people who export that product have some political clout.
Say, Iowa soybeans or Florida oranges. Another risk here, says University of Michigan's Linda Lim, is that other countries could impose national security justifications of their own.
Saying, I need shoes, I need hats, whatever, for national security, I need sunscreen. That just opens a whole can of worms.
Lim says if the U.S. does impose tariffs and quotas, steel prices will surely rise here, and our trading partners will protest at next month's G20 summit in Germany. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, stocks fell a little bit, whatever. Commodity of choice this Tuesday, though, was oil, down more than 2%, $43 and change a barrel and heading down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Sometimes you go out on a reporting trip and you bring back the story you pretty much expected you'd get. Sometimes, though, if you're doing it right, you come back with stories you didn't expect you'd get at all. We have been spending, as I think you know, a good deal of time in Erie, Pennsylvania this year for our series The Big Promise, how Donald Trump's campaign promises are playing out in places that voted for him. Marketplace's Caitlin Esch has produced most of the stories that I've done from Erie. Today, though, a story of her own about technology and infrastructure and digital life in rural America.
One of the things you notice driving around Northwest Pennsylvania, aside from the rolling hills, the old farmhouses, and the occasional small town, are video stores, a lot of them. At Family Video in Erie City, manager Jamie Buey rings up a customer with a towering stack of DVDs.
You still have your half-off program on here as well, so everything's going to be half price for you today.
Half off the towering stack and a free 5-day rental to boot.
It's the customer service aspect that keeps us alive here.
That, and probably the lack of high-speed internet. Nearly 40% of people in rural Erie County don't have access to broadband, as defined by the FCC. That means internet that's fast enough to, say, stream House of Cards or a movie. Buey says that's one of the reasons she took a job here 5 years ago.
For the longest time, we had satellite internet. And with satellite internet, you have no way to stream movies at all. So that was why I originally picked my job with Family Video, was so I could get cheap rentals.
Even if Erie's internet problems are good for the movie rental business, they're holding many others back. In rural Green Township, about 20 minutes from downtown, Paul Zernacki runs a taxidermy business out of his house. That's kind of common around here.
Well, we've got deer heads, we've got turkeys, we've got waterfowl, we've got fish.
At the moment, Zernacki is mounting a brown trout. Paperclips hold its fins as they dry. Then he'll paint the fish scale by scale.
It's tedious.
The look he's after?
Lifelike. Realism to the nth degree.
You know, the kind of thing you'd fire up Google Images for. Zernacki also goes online to connect with customers, like that guy who shipped a giant saltwater crocodile from Australia.
17-footer, which was pretty neat.
But until recently, the Zernacki family had to make do with just 40 gigabytes of data through their smartphone plan, and it cost them $350 a month.
And you didn't dare get close to the 40 because the overage charges are ridiculous.
That's Christy Mahaney, Zernacki's wife. She says before they were able to get an unlimited plan, each digital interaction came with a cost-benefit analysis. Even for school, when 7-year-old Dylan needed to watch an educational video online.
how do you do that when you don't know if you're going to have enough data for it or not? Because if you watch a movie for about an hour and a half, that's about 2 gigs. You're totally doing the math the entire time.
Politicians have been promising to close the digital divide for years, and still roughly 40% of people in rural areas don't have access to broadband, compared to just 4% in cities. And Erie has fought to get big companies like Verizon and Spectrum to bring the county up to speed. But companies don't want to invest unless it's profitable. Lisa Vallemont is a Green Township supervisor and the point person on this.
We, a lot of times, don't meet the 20 homes per mile criteria that a lot of these internet companies want.
So, Vallemont says,
you know, the residents would be required to pay the installation of an estimated $20,000.
Pennsylvania does have a law on the books that required broadband access for everyone by 2015. The problem is it only applied to telephone companies, not cable or internet companies. And it was written in 2004 when high speed meant a download speed of 1.5 megabits per second. The FCC standard for 2017, 25 megabits per second. Not exactly the sales pitch Christy Mahaney prefers to deliver when she's trying to sell a house. She's a real estate agent in Erie County.
Oh, you want to live there? Well, just so you know, you can't get internet. And can't get internet is almost like saying you have to bring a bucket out to the well and pump your own water.
Whether the Trump administration will actually change that conversation remains to be seen. In Erie County, I'm Caitlin Esch for Marketplace.
Travel and Leisure magazine has had just about enough of Americans leaving vacation days unused every year. There's a special edition of the magazine out today called Operation Vacation. Deals and travel tips to get, well, us, because mea culpa, to take more time off. Nathan Lump is the editor-in-chief at the magazine. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
Why is it a bad thing if people don't take vacation? I mean, what's the problem?
You know, I think that when people don't take their time off, they don't have any mental space, basically, to get away from the, you know, both the stress but also the demands of the office. And you know, there's plenty of research out there that suggests that that's actually not good for people's productivity. It's not good for their creativity. There's also a really big economic impact to this. You know, the Project Time Off research says that, you know, there's as much as a, you know, $236 billion economic impact of people not taking this time. Because also when people take time off, they tend to spend money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually a good mover for the economy. You know, if people took even just one more day a year than they do, the people who leave unused days on the table, that's $33 billion in the economy.
Okay, but the reason people don't take vacation is usually they're worried that it's going to impact their, I guess you would say, their reputation at work, right? It's my boss won't let me take vacation. He'll get cranky with me. She'll get cranky with me, you know, whatever. How do you counter that problem?
The number one reason actually why people don't take vacation days is that they're worried about the mountain of work that they're going to come back to.
Really?
So they do care about reputation, but they also, what's happening is that people feel like they have so much work to do that's going to be undone while they're away that it diminishes their enjoyment of the time off. And we think, you know, that there's a lot of work to be done in terms of creating workplace culture that makes it okay for people. Because when you ask managers what they feel about this, they will say that they think that ultimately their employees come back more refreshed and more productive when they take time off. So why aren't we talking about this as something that's beneficial?
We are by far the outlier globally in not taking vacation, right? I mean, we don't take vacation more than any other country on the planet, probably.
So that's not quite true. Countries, particularly South Korea and Japan, are similar to us. So according to some research that I've seen that Expedia does, actually, the South Koreans are one of the worst. They take about 8 to 15 days a year. Uh-huh. I think what's a little bit different about Americans is that we get fewer days than anyone else. So the fact that we then also only take maybe half of them is particularly telling and particularly poor.
When was the last time you took a vacation?
Me. Well, I take vacations all the time, although it's a little bit.
Says the guy who works Travel and Leisure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. I can't describe them as vacations entirely because I'm always a little bit working, but I am lucky that I get to go all over the world all the time. I'm out of the office a lot. And, you know, I tend to do a lot of blending, some folks will call bleisure travel, where I'm doing some business but also taking some time for myself.
What about this thing, actually, now that you – bleisure, whatever that word – I don't even know what that word is, right? What about people who, like, they go away but they're still on email, you know?
Yeah, I mean, definitely a lot of folks are staying connected. Personally, I don't think that has to be a problem. I stay connected while I take – even when I take vacation, what I try to do is concentrate my time. So say, you know what, I'm gonna take 30 minutes or 60 minutes in the morning and then I'm going to disconnect during the day. And that allows me to enjoy that time. Thinking about that mountain of work that people are scared about coming back to, I think that can make it better.
Nathan Lump, he's the editor-in-chief at Travel and Leisure. Nathan, thanks a lot.
Yep, thank you.
Coming up.
So this is the whole new world of sonic seasoning.
Which means tasting with your ears, for reals. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, here you go. The Dow Industrial's off 61 points today, 0.2%, 21,467. The NASDAQ down 50 points, 0.08%, 6188. S&P 500 down 16, 0.6%, 2437. Health insurers are keeping a keen eye on the so far secret legislative work of Senate Republicans. Not getting them much, though. Cigna down 0.4%. Aetna down less than 0.1%. United Health Group gained about 0.1%. Oil, as we promised, here's the deal. Supply, demand, that whole thing, a supply glut is pushing prices down. 3 years ago this month, by the by, was when oil hit its peak. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.15%. And you are listening to Marketplace. Hi, everybody. It's Kai Rizdahl. Marketplace is in the final week of fundraising before our books close for the year. We're asking you to step up and help support us today so that we can continue the in-depth, independent economic coverage you rely on. Any amount, even a small donation every month, counts. We appreciate your support. So please give today at marketplace.org/donate. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A quick detour into aerodynamics by way of setting up this next story. When air gets really, really hot, like 120 degrees hot, it gets less dense. The air molecules are actually farther apart, which means two things for the air traveling public in the Southwest United States this week. One, your plane is going to have to go faster to generate enough airflow over its wings to get enough lift to get off the ground. But also, number two, the engines on those planes are going to be able to generate less thrust. Or, as American Airlines out of Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport puts it, your flight is canceled. Or, if you're lucky, just delayed. It is literally too hot to fly. And with the planet only getting warmer, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports delayed or canceled flights are just the tip of the economic consequences.
Flight cancellations due to heat, like the ones in Phoenix today, are pretty rare. But behind the scenes, airlines regularly make weight adjustments for heat. Billy Nolan is with Airlines for America, the industry trade group.
Almost on any day, there's some sort of weight restriction in the summertime just due to the temperatures and the length of the runway, which is another component of this performance calculation.
So maybe a plane will carry a little less fuel or a little less cargo to compensate. With rising global temperatures, other businesses may have to compensate too.
The big economic impact is reduced labor productivity.
Kate Gordon works with the Risky Business Project, which looks at the economic effects of climate change.
Any kind of outdoor activity, transportation, construction, anything manufacturing that's outside, we're going to see that kind of reduced labor productivity and potentially just inability to work during the day.
She expects to see some of those jobs moving to nighttime shifts in the future to beat soaring temperatures. More frequent heat waves could also affect the agriculture sector and the energy grid. John Riley is with the MIT Joint Program on the Science and Policy of Global Change.
We're also concerned a bit about large transformers in the grid. Older ones are very vulnerable to high heat and could kind of go down and cause a major outage of electricity.
As in blackouts, just when you need your air conditioning the most. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Consider this the next time you're out to eat someplace. How you're perceiving whatever it is that you're eating or drinking is likely only partially related to whatever it is that you're eating or drinking. Environmental factors, from how much the cutlery weighs to what music is playing in the background, can change your perceptions. That's the thesis of Charles Spence's new book. He's a professor of experimental psychology at Oxford. The book is called Gastrophysics, the New Science of Eating. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
The feeling I had when I was reading this book was that, and this is going to sound a little bit pejorative, but that consumers of food, whether in restaurant or you know, in a snack bar or a candy bar, we're almost having one put over on us because everybody out there knows more about it than we do, and we're just eating.
In a way, we can frame things that way. Certainly when you hear of, you know, some big evil chain out there doing things to make us buy more, eat more, shop more, it seems that way. But I think really we're more interested in those chefs who are already, you know, delivering great food but want to enhance the experience even further. We're interested in working with hospitals and old people's homes to try and take the scientific insights and use them to help people eat better. We're interested in working with brands even who want to kind of reduce or being told to reduce some of the unhealthy stuff in the food and drinks that they sell and serve. But realize when they do that, people, we complain. We say, give us back our brand the way it was. I don't like the new taste.
Okay, so we're going to do a little experiment here. I have in front of me, we were gonna try to get some actual English toffee, but we got as close as we could, which is a Heath bar, which on the front of it says milk chocolate English toffee bar. And my producer, Bridget, is going to play some music, and you're going to tell me why this music works with me eating a toffee bar, right? Oh, I know this. All right, can I eat now?
Yes.
So this is Leonard Cohen, Hallelujah, of course, and I'm going to have some English toffee. More crunchy. All right, so why am I listening to Leonard Cohen while I'm eating this?
So this is the whole new world of sonic seasoning. We all believe, chefs, psychologists, regular diners, food critics alike, that we can just taste what's on the plate or in our glass and that we're not going to be fooled by... Oh, there, I use that word. I'm not going to be so affected by
See?
By the everything else that, you know, I can read the research and somebody can tell me that sound will change the taste, but you know, I can taste what's in the glass. And yet, if I play that lower pitched music, it does seem to bring out the more bitter notes in a dish. If I play some tinkling, high pitched music instead, wind chimes or high notes on the piano, then that will seem to accentuate the sweetness. So it's something that's already there in your tasting experience. And if I were a wine expert, I could tell you, can't you taste the asparagus? Can't you taste this? And suddenly when I say those words, for some people, I get it. Yeah. It was there all along, but you weren't really paying attention to it. You couldn't focus on it.
This this research seems of use to large food companies who have a profit motive on the line and who, we should say, fund a good part of your research, but also the high-end restaurants who have the latitude, I guess, to experiment, right? Do you see much crossover that winds its way down to the common man?
Absolutely. I'm seeing, for us, I mean, we have worked for two decades with the food and beverage industry, and they fund most of the research that we do. But I think you can take the insights from there and apply them to the mainstream. So, for example, a cafeteria over in Vietnam opened a few months ago called the Jin Cafe, kind of sonic seasoning, and they've decided to play sweet sounds all the time so that they can add a little bit less sugar to their cakes and pastries and so hopefully deliver a great tasting experience for their customers but also with a bit less sugar, which might help in the long term in some small way deal with the growing crisis we have with obesity.
Has this research, just on a personal level for you, has it taken all the fun out of going out to eat? I mean, are you constantly assessing things?
If you only knew how little Oxford academics get paid, you'd understand that I would never get the chance to go to one of these fancy restaurants on my regular salary. So far, we've had like three decades of science in the kitchen, kind of modernist cuisine, molecular gastronomy, spumes and foams and gels. But we've been kind of missing the science of the diner, of the mind of the diner. And our enjoyment of food doesn't happen in our mouth, really. It actually happens in our mind. And so that's what you really need to understand if you want us to deliver, you know, the ultimate meal experiences or even nudge us all towards a slightly healthier and a more sustainable food future.
Charles Spence is a professor of experimental psychology at Oxford. He's also the head of the Crossmodal Research Lab there. His book is called Gastrophysics, the New Science of Eating. Thanks a lot for your time, Charles.
Thank you.
Honestly, by the way, that toffee candy bar thing tasted exactly the same with music and without. Final note on the way out. The quote of the day today goes to Senator John McCain, Republican of Arizona, asked whether he had seen Senator McConnell's secret health care bill. McCain said no, he hasn't. And this is a quote from Bloomberg, nor have I met any American that has. I'm sure the Russians have been able to hack in and gotten most of it. End of quote. Boom, boom. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 61 today, 0.2%. NASDAQ down 58.1%. S&P 500 off 16.6%. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcoat, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.